Well, I guess we don't even know whose channel this is going to be on, so maybe it's just going to be the triumvirate kind of.
We could have each of our feed on our different channels, and people need to have all three windows going at the same
time. Some sort of choose your own podcast kind of assemblage, a la carte. Yeah, well, I guess we're living in the end times, or are we always living in the end times?
It's the resurrection.
Depends the end of what, yeah. But it, for sure, it feels like we're living in some kind of end of something. I don't see how that can be avoided at this point. I don't know how big the end is, but it's definitely seems like things are falling apart in a way that is very, very... it's larger than what it has been before. And so I don't know what it leads to, but it's not particularly, there's not a lot of hope, it seems, right now. At least I don't have a lot of hope, not in the short term.
You know, it's interesting because we feel that, but if you compare our times to the the Great Depression, the early 30s, the American Revolution, French and Indian War. I mean, there's the War of 1812. It's very interesting how we sort of feel this, but many people point, well, the economy, even with COVID, you know, we don't have large numbers of troops. You know, we're not in the middle of a war. So it's very interesting to me why we feel this and why we agree that this is what's happening, even though we're not seeing all these other things. Now, maybe these things will come, and I think that's part of what we're afraid of. But
I agree. I totally agree. I think that in a way we are living in the most peaceful time, you know, in the history of the world. But at the same time, there is this sense, there's a sense that things are breaking apart in terms of narrative, in terms of identities, in terms of social cohesion. And so I think that anybody who's astute can realize that unless this is solved, then it's going to at some point lead to conflict. It's just inevitable. How it's going to happen, the manner in which it's going to manifest itself, it's hard to fully predict. But you can't have a society that doesn't have any glue. It just doesn't work. And we tried capitalism. We tried the idea of consuming. That consuming can be the glue of our society, but that's not enough. It's definitely not enough. So,
but I mean, this is something that we've all been staring at for a number of years now, probably more or less in different degrees. That social underpinning or that glue. I see you guys both strategizing ways to, I guess, restart it or recongeal it. But is that possible anymore? That's the big question. We've all talked about this before. Is it possible for our society to have cohesion in a multicultural manner, in a polytheism manner, and not classical polytheism, but I'm just like a bunch of different kinds of conceptions of the end, the beginning, and what's going on in the present?
There are ways of doing it, but let's say Rome did it. They definitely did it, but it didn't last forever. It broke down because the way they did it was the way the 20th century tried to do it, which is a god emperor, right? So if you have a god emperor, then everybody focuses their worship on the emperor. Then you can worship all kinds of other things. It doesn't bother them. As long as you worship the emperor, then it's okay. Then we're going to hold together. But yeah, I mean, it worked for a few centuries. You know, they held it together for a few centuries, although it was kind of careening for a while there. But then it broke down.
By 20th century representations of that, you're talking about like Stalin and Hitler. You're talking about big leaders like that.
Yeah, the strongman idea and the strongman leader who kind of focuses the attention of everybody and becomes a person into which people unite, let's say.
Well, Trump is like that, only the opposite. He's the person in which everybody's focus converges to disunite.
Yep. Yeah, well, in that sense, he's a scapegoat. He could be a scapegoat figure, And so if enough people agreed to hate Donald Trump in the United States, then that could be a way to unify people. But I don't see that as a very positive thing. Like, I really don't see that. I don't see it happening, first of all. And second of all, I don't think that it would lead to good things.
I think Jonathan's point in the Kanye video that he just released, that video is transformative for me in some ways, because when Kanye says something like, we all need to unite under God, we hear that in how we understand God to be and how we understand that unity to be is very much set by, you know, I think in terms of American memory, Cold War ideas. Hmm. But when you look at what happened with Constantine and the breakdown of Rome took centuries, but in a way, Rome never broke down. So you have these German princes of Europe calling themselves the Holy Roman Emperor. And of course, historians for a long time said they weren't holy, they weren't Roman, and they weren't really emperors. I think and this is where Jonathan's work has been so impactful for me, because he has illuminated these structures that actually served the West for centuries, aspirationally,
yeah,
never quite were able to pull them together, but they are viable structures. And sort of what happens in modernity is we say, we don't believe in those structures. We only believe in competence and pragmatism, and that will be sufficient. And I think what we're seeing now is, no, it isn't.
And in a certain respect, the opposite of the pragmatic and the competent is like kind of coming in to take the place by means of, it's veiled... It's veiled in the terms of equality and justice, but it's really anti-competence and anti-pragmatic. It doesn't make any sense, and the worst possible people get to the top of it.
Right. On both the right and the left right now, because Trump is sort of that on the right. He's not competent. He's anti-competent. And the left is playing the same game. And so so then you've got people in the middle that are saying competence, competence, but in a sense, modernity, that was modernity's call, and modernity is done.
The standards are falling. The standards are falling.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a... I think that... The problem, I think the difficulty, the problem of the modernity thing kind of falling apart is really the difficulty of inclusion and equality. We talked about that. I try to talk about it once in a while, is that if you remove hierarchy, or you see hierarchy as somewhat negative, you know, and that's kind of like the scientism fallacy, where we want to get to the lowest level. We want to get to the idea of just these phenomena that would be objective. Then once you remove hierarchy, you have to include everything. And that's what they're trying to do, like the whole diversity, inclusion, all that stuff. They're trying to include everything. They want everything to be inside, because as soon as there's an inside and an outside, you have a hierarchy problem.
Yeah.
Right. And so then they want, it's almost like an unconscious drive to want to include everything. But the problem is to try to include everything equally. And that just doesn't work.
I think we're seeing the limit of that now. They're no longer pretending to be inclusive. They're now openly going after they're no longer including everything. They're inverting everything. They're inverting the hierarchy by saying, you know, white European culture has gone around and claimed everything, you know, that, like, Neil deGrasse Tyson, a famous scientist, said that just the other day. It's like six words to define Western culture. We came, we saw, we conquered, or something like that. This conception of this European tradition as completely colonialist and exploitative. And that's happening on every level with regards to the ways in which Black Lives Matter, just as a as an image, now needs an inversion where, like, even though you go in and you argue whether or not all lives matter is proper or not, but in practice, it's asking and is promoting the devaluation or the bowing down of white people, which we saw last month, literally to this inverted conceptual hierarchy.
We've been working at this in a strange way, though, because 30, 20 years ago, we had Barney the dinosaur singing, "You are special, you're the only one, you're the only one like you." And so on one hand, we have this radical equality. There's no exclusion at all. At the same time, I myself am special. And your conversation, Benjamin, with James Lindsay, where he talked about, you know, the only thing you can't deconstruct is your own oppression. So you both have this radical individuality where my particular oppression is sacred, and that's sort of the Cartesian thing I cannot doubt, in the midst of a public declaration that all are in, as Jonathan notes. And quite obviously, this can't work. And so it's not going to go anywhere. It can't.
Yeah, but to the point that Benjamin was making, the thing is that this is an image that I've been bringing up more and more, the nakedness of Noah, trying to kind of talk about that. And there is a sin in colonialism. Like, there is a sin which was hidden, and it was, we're invading your land, and we're going to pretend like we're doing it to help you. And they're not the only ones who did it. The Romans did something similar even before Christianity. It was always like a benevolent, we're going to be benevolent dictators. And so that mask is kind of came off with colonialism, decolonization, and kind of decolonialist approach and post-colonialism and all that stuff. The post-colonial attitude, although it has its serious problems because of what it leads to, the basic idea of saying, you know, stop pretending like this was just for our good. It wasn't. There are nefarious things hidden in your agenda. And so as those are exposed, then we have this like removing of this exposing the nakedness of Noah, let's say, right? Exposing the nakedness of the modern project, how it's related to colonialism, how it's related even to the modern slavery in the U.S. was related to weird enlightenment kind of superiority complex thing. And so it's the revelation of that is a real one. Now, the problem is,
okay,
how do we deal with it? Like, how do we now heal that exposure without destroying everything? And I don't see the discussion being had. You know, I brought up storytelling before where, you know, when you read the Iliad, for example, there are several ways to read the Iliad. There are ways to read the Iliad in which the Greeks are the heroes or the main characters, and there are ways to read the Iliad in which the Trojans are the heroes and the main characters. And you see the Romans took up the position of the Trojans in the Iliad and saw themselves as the descendants of the Trojans. And so in epic storytelling, there is a manner in which you can have complexity. Like, you can have the notion that the characters are doing evil, they're doing good, and the other side is also doing evil and doing good. And so there's a way to tell that story where we can inhabit the different characters. And that's like real, real storytelling. Now, the difficulty that we're dealing with now is right. It's just, we see the evil of our fathers. Like I said, we see the evil of the European fathers, and now we want to destroy everything. But the thing is that those who are doing the destroying also have their own evils that they're hiding. They also have their own nakedness, which they are hiding as they're attacking the other. Mm-hmm. And so it's always just a question of time before that comes out.
Yeah.
I wish there was way, like one thing I've mentioned recently is, there could be a way to reinterpret, for example, Far West, like mythology, like the U.S. Far West mythology, in a way that would have an epic version of that, right? Which would have the capacity to show the evils done by the colonizer, you know, and then the evils done by the other side as well, to show the two sides as having heroes and villains. Mm-hmm. I mean, there could be ways to do that to kind of try to heal these rifts, but I'm not sure that it's possible anymore.
Hmm. Well, we're also in the case that every African-American is the descendant of slave owner and slave. Almost every Native American is the descendant, the physical descendant of colonizer and colonized. I mean, we're very quickly a mixed multitude, yet the identity element that gets salient is obviously instrumental in the way a particular narrative is promoted,
yeah,
and then the demands made by that narrative upon the public.
Yeah. And I think there are places, you know, the thing is that there are places where the real healing can happen, and I'm seeing them happen. It's just that they're not happening. They're happening in the private sphere. They're happening in people's lives. They're happening as people do the work to kind of integrate those two things. I have one of my best friends when I was a young man, and when I was 14, 15, I met him at a camp, and we had this amazing connection together. And he's half black, half white, and he's the descendant of massive slaveholders, like horrible, horrible slaveholders. And he's also a descendant of slaves at the same time. And I'm watching him, we're having a lot of discussion, we're talking, we're exchanging, and I'm watching him try to do the work in himself to reconcile the evils of his own past, like identifying with the slaveholder in him, and at the same time understanding the difficulty of being identified as a black man in America, because, you know, he looks black, like, he, in terms of the cultural markers, the kind of simple cultural markers we have, like, if you saw him, you could see that he's not a white guy. Mm-hmm. And so he's working, I can see him, he's struggling, and he's working on that in himself, and it's powerful to watch happen. But it's something which is happening in the heart of a person. And I mean, I it's the kind of thing where you say the waves of that will unfurl. Like, there will be waves of that amazing work being done, but I don't know how fast that needs to happen, you know.
Mm-hmm. Is there, I guess, one thing that is the problem of modernity and ergo postmodernity is that trying to find that glue between multiple different narratives. Is there one narrative structure, an epic structure, that can facilitate the constellation and conflict and then the harmonization and resolution of all these different identities and all these different histories and all these different traditions, right? That respects and upholds them all, but somehow converges them on a greater good. Like, in one respect, Christianity did that for the West, but can it do that for everything? Can it keep on getting wider and wider and wider without collapsing in this, like, completely equal plane, right? As far as the pyramid structure
would go. Well, I think in terms of story, I think the story of Christ, he can't beat it. He just can't beat that story in terms of its capacity to reconcile as, let's say, as Christians, especially, you know, when you go to church, for example, you have to, like, especially in a traditional church, you really have to understand that the priest is the representative of Christ for you, let's say. He manifests Christ to you, but he's also the one who's operating the sacrifice in the Holy of Holies. And so he is both the killer of Christ and also manifesting Christ. Hmm. And so he is this image of, he is showing us the mystery of Christianity and how this notion that the killer and the victim can be reunited in a way that it is totally possible. And you see it in the story of Christianity. St. Paul is a version of that. Like, you see in the story of St. Paul how it's one image of how the persecutor joined with his victim and then created something amazing and, you know, became a light to the Gentiles because he was able to unite those two identities together.
And what's the key that facilitates the redemption of the victor and the, I guess, the salvation of the victim from that bind? What's the key concept or the core of that change?
Well, the idea is self-sacrifice. Like, that's the key. That's the key. The idea is, instead of doing it in others, you do it in yourself. And then if you do that, mm-hmm. then you become a healing mechanism for the world. That's what I think, anyways.
I always pondered the fact that in the book of Acts, you have Paul holding the cloaks of the stoners of Stephen, and the heavens open and Stephen seeing the Lord and all of that. Guess who doesn't appear to Paul at that moment? But Paul goes on this rampage, hunting and killing the followers of Jesus, and then it's on the road to Damascus. And I would imagine the families of the victims of Paul between Stephen and the road to Damascus saying to God, now, would it have been so hard to, you know, strike him there next to Stephen? You know, you could have done it all in one trip, okay? but no, you wait. But that's not, you know, that's intentional. And I think that's exactly what Jonathan said in terms of Paul had to manifest the killer and the tyrant and the colonizer before he could manifest Christ.
Could we push this a little further and ask if the left needs to, I'm speaking in American terms, if the left needs to manifest Antifa before they can manifest, you know, their utopia, you know? Do they have to go on a burning, pillaging rampage before they get to a point where they can actually do what they're proposing?
I think it's possible that this needs to happen. I always quote the same quote from Christ, which is, you know, scandal must happen, but woe to those by whom it happens. I think that it's possible that we need to go through this in order to come out on the other side, but I don't justify the acts of those that are doing it. And I don't think the same, even with St. Paul, I wouldn't say that St. Paul was right in doing what he was doing. I'm not saying, but I can admit that for him to have become what he became, he had to go through that.
Okay.
And Ananias, so, you know, the drama gets played out. So, of course, why did God have to strike him blind and then call one of his potential victims and say, go find Paul on Straight Street and pray for him? And then Ananias says, you're asking the lamb to minister to the lion? Mm. And then the words of the Spirit to Ananias are key. I will show him how much he has to suffer. And so that suffering of Paul is, and that ongoing suffering, you know, the thorn in the flesh, I mean, the whole story of Paul, it's all in there.
Hmm. So there's no cap, there's no, I guess, release from suffering then. That's kind of there's an embracing of it and then a constellation of that suffering into the mechanisms of what drove Paul through the rest of his life then.
Well, for sure. In Christianity, you know, and I say this as a full hypocrite, like a total hypocrite when I say this, but I mean, for sure in Christianity, there is the idea that it's not that we are absolved of suffering, but it's that suffering can be transformed into glory, that suffering can be a portal to something which transcends. And it's not to say that suffering in itself is good and not like a masochist or something, but it's mostly to understand that it's the transformation of suffering into meaning. It's a good way to say it, which is kind of the glorification of suffering.
Yeah.
And nowhere, right in the Lord's Prayer, we're invited to ask for that we not suffer, deliver us from evil, do not lead us into the time of testing. Nowhere in Christianity are we told to seek suffering in and of itself, but we're always told it is inevitable. It will come. And when it comes, this is how you go into it.
There's this script that's being run right now, and it's loosely affiliated under the umbrella of anti-racism. But if you see how certain portions of our society are internalizing that, what it actually does is like a mind virus that causes you to see racism everywhere. And I'm I found a advice column where this young girl writes in to this advisor, and she's like, you know, my boyfriend's not posting enough about Black Lives Matter. He protests every day, but he's really not doing the work. And I went and I saw all of his friends aren't posting enough. And I don't know what should I do about, like, you know, making them do this thing. And the advice columnist was like, turned it again back on her. It's this this constant involution of, and it seems like a broken Christianity. A lot of the elements that I see in the left are a hobbled form of mechanisms within the church, but they're not, they're kind of broken loose, and then they just spin off on their own.
Oh yeah, that's exactly what it is. And you know, I am probably going to make a video about this soon, but I can give you a hint of what I'm going to say, which is that in the Bible, there's a warning about all these things. Like in Scripture, in the New Testament, all of these patterns are played out in a way to help us see what's going to happen. And so, for example, so Christ talks about on the Sermon on the Mount, you know, Christ talks about the poor and about helping, you know, about the special role that those who suffer, that those who are persecuted, that those, all of that, the special role that they play. And so the left, that's what they have. That's the let's say liberal Christianity and the left, they've taken that aspect of Christ and they've ran with it. And they said, this is Christianity. And, or not, even if they're secular, like, this is it. This is the main thing. Mm-hmm. And the value of what Christ said in those moments is absolutely true. And the things that Christ said are absolutely true, but you always have to see the story, the full story. And so there's another part in Scripture, and Christ has very few interaction with Judas. Like, there are very few, but those that he has are key to understanding his interactions. And the one interaction that he has is when a woman comes to wash his feet with perfume. So she takes this expensive perfume and she washes his feet. And so it's an act of worship. She's worshiping Christ. And Judas's answer is, he says, we should have given that money to the poor. But he wasn't really thinking that. He was thinking, we should give that money to the poor. I want that money for myself. Like, it was a duplicitous act. Was a way to attract attention, things onto himself, right? And that's when Christ, like, gets angry with them and says, you know, you'll always have the poor, but the Son of Man, you know, he won't be with you for very long. And so he's setting up the hierarchy. He's saying, of course you have to care for the poor. Of course you have to, but you have to do it in the right order. It can't just be that. Hmm. Worship comes first. Then from the worship, if you don't want the helping the poor to become a self-serving kind of perverted act, then you have to have worship first. You have to look up first and then look down and help others. But if you just do the look down, it's going to become disturbing and it's going to become an inversion. And that's, I think that's what we're seeing now.
Or if the act of looking up is looking upon your own mightiness or your own virtue in a way.
Right. But you have to look up beyond you, like in that sense. And so I think that in that story, you really do have this image of the anger of Christ at things just not being in their right place. Because if you just took that story, you could just isolate that and say, well, here's Christ saying, you know, you shouldn't help the poor. But of course, that's not what he's saying. Yeah. Because in other places, he'll say that abundantly.
In the contemporary government helping culture, so my whole life, my father's ministry, my ministry has always been lived in the context of communities where there is massive government effort to help the poor. For the most part, when you have government efforts to help the poor, do you know where most of the money goes? It goes to the people who are managing the poverty programs, which are all the nice people with, you know, with social work degrees who are working in all of the government agencies. In a sense, it's all Judas. This money should go to help the poor. Oh, you mean so it would go into your purse, Judas? Because that's, in a sense, where government money really goes when we help the poor. And again, I'm not dissing any of these programs. Many of these programs are helpful and vital and all of that. But if you look at, well, the cost of running the program goes to all of the people with nice master's and social work degrees and the entire hierarchy. And again, you know, that gets into I watched both of your videos quite a bit. And Benjamin, your video with your second video with James Lindsay, where you talked about how in some ways this entire narrative sets up the middle class job security for a certain class of people. Mm-hmm. And the poor themselves, and that's my frustration, having worked in places of poverty generationally in the United States, the poverty doesn't change. The poor are being helped a little bit, but it's this entire Judas purse mechanism that gets funded by the government on the lips of, oh, we've got to help the poor. So that story plays itself out as well.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. To bring it back just a little bit, you mentioned worship. So I want this is a really difficult concept for us to conceptualize. And all of your language, both of your languages, it's always pointing outside of language. You guys are always pointing at, you're even literally pointing out of the screen. Like it's like something like, how do we conceptualize this right now? Or how would you facilitate the conceptualization of that for people who don't have the structure of a religious background to draw upon? Like, how do you go about, like, understanding?
Well, it's pretty simple. It's like you always celebrate. If you don't like, let's use the word celebrate. It's an easier word to understand than worship, because people, obviously worship is more than just celebration. But because worship is maybe difficult for people to understand, let's say celebrate. So we always celebrate the thing that binds us, right? We just will. It just will happen. And, you know, and then what happens is you have competing things to celebrate. And so right now we are being asked, let's say in the past few years, that the one thing that you really, really have to celebrate is, for example, pride. And everybody celebrates pride. Like all the corporations, you know, they'll change their logo, they'll change, you know, and so there's a worship happening. We create objects, we create events where we sing songs, where we gather together in the name of something. You know, all of that is the notion of celebrating or worshiping in a small W, let's say, venerating. Let's use the word venerating, okay? And so, and we venerate those who are markers of what binds us. So we have the right to venerate certain figures. Let's say, for example, someone who pretty much everybody can still venerate right now is Martin Luther King. Everybody can venerate Martin Luther King, right? And then
argument on that.
He has nakedness too. Everybody has nakedness. He has a darkness in his hidden darkness as well. But there are some figures, and then there's people that are fighting for us to venerate certain figures that manifest that thing. You know, like, so let's say Harvey Milk, you know, I've seen icons of Harvey Milk being made, or different characters, right? And so so everybody understands that, because we all do it. Now, the problem is that if you stop your celebration at a small G God, right, then that's when you have the fight, right? That's when you have the massive fights, because the different principalities, the different gods are fighting amongst each other. So what are going to be the leading values, the leading things, the leading concepts that are going to unite us? Or so then you end up, that's what you end up happening. So the idea is the religious people, the Christians, the Jews, and yes, you know, the Muslims or the Zoroastrians or even the Neoplatonists, the revelation that slowly kind of came down was that If we're able to actually bring it up into the highest, right, that we celebrate the highest thing which transcends everything, then what it's going to do is it's going to moderate all the principalities below. It's going to make them less prone to fighting amongst each other. And so let's say in Christianity we say it's love. Love is, God is love. God is the manner in which things exist together and apart at the same time. He is the principle by which things exist together and apart at the same time. So he's the principle of unity and multiplicity. And so we have the Trinity, we have all these images, the duality of the nature of Christ, all these images to help us participate in that one in many, infinite one in many. Mm-hmm. Okay. And so that's what worship is. Worship is celebrating the highest. And so in terms of religious worship, then it has specific ways we do it. We sing, we recite, we pray, most of the time it has to do with vocalizing, mm-hmm. by saying things or singing things, you know, through logos to participate. But there's also bowing, kneeling, making yourself low. There's also loving others. Like, by loving others, you are also worshiping, because you are embodying the love that is supposed to be, that you're manifesting the love of God. So when I say that, like, you're manifesting the love of God, it just sounds like something that doesn't mean anything, but it really is a pattern of reality. It's not just a sentimental statement.
I just want to make sense to a secular person. I want to make one quick footnote that people can visualize what you're talking about, because the pride flag was a rainbow that meant diversity, but now there's these new iterations of the pride flag that are being compacted by all these other identities, and it's just becoming this really ugly, like, war zone. Like, this flag is just becoming this, is being torn apart on an aesthetic level, because that unity has been now lost by all these minor principalities or identities.
That's because the way to understand the rainbow is to understand it as a circumzenithal arc. Like, if you look at the sun and there's a rainbow around the sun, that's the symbolism of the rainbow. The rainbow is a periphery, and the sun is in the middle. If you don't have the sun, you don't have a rainbow. If you don't have white light, you don't have a rainbow. If you need the center for the periphery to even have any sense, to make any sense. So you one and many, you need both.
And I think the conceptual, you know, Benjamin, you said conceptualization. I think it's not that people need to conceptualize, people need to practice it. And in a healthy liturgical diet, you have all of the elements of the manifestations. And it's not so much, I mean, this is part of the sin of Protestantism, is that, well, if I can conceptualize it, then I can master it and I can wield it. No, it's always service. That's worship. You know, worship is, in a sense, service. And what happens, what you do in church, in the liturgy, is that you go through all of the movements of this. Somebody pointed out to me yesterday that the one element of Protestant liturgy that has been eliminated over the last 50-70 years has been confession. If you go to a Protestant church with acrobats and smoke machines, the one element you won't have that has been taken out is confession.
Is that the similar to testimony, like the testimonial kind of thing?
No, the testimony confession is the part of the liturgy where we say, it's not the colonizers, it's not the racists, it's not the killers of Christ who are responsible for the sin of the world, it's me. And so that has come out of Christian liturgy in the Protestant church. Now we see it manifest in the street enormously. And it's like the elements of liturgy will not be denied. And so if you fail to practice them within the confines, now I sound terribly, you know, orthodox here. Yeah. If you fail to practice them within the confines of the properly structured universe, which is what an Orthodox church is in terms of the architecture and everything, if you fail to practice them inside, they will leak out, and you will, in a sense, you will have to fulfill the prophecy, but mm-hmm. in a far more okay. destructive way. And in that sense, the church unruly. Is a containment unit.
Yeah.
Okay. I made this observation last year, just because being on Twitter, you're assaulted constantly by, you know, the hashtags. And I noticed that, like, our society is slowly going back to Catholicism, but instead of having a patron saint for a day, we have a patron identity. You have this month is given to this identity, this day to that identity. Do you think that we're headed in a trajectory where we'll just reboot Orthodoxy with this kind of identity? identity element to it, where all, like I was saying earlier, where all these different traditions, all these different histories have their own proper place, and they are all unified and equalized across the a calendar year. Do you think that that will...
Think it's going to happen? No, I don't think it's going to happen. No.
Okay.
No. Well, there are many reasons why it's not going to happen. One is... that we don't celebrate ideas. We celebrate people, right? And we celebrate events and we celebrate people, but we don't celebrate ideas. No one cares about
and
that it, stuff.
Identity is an idea. Is that what you're saying? An identity is not.
Yeah, yeah. And you see, it's like Earth Day. Who really celebrates Earth Day? I mean, no one really celebrates Earth Day. It's not. It's like
420, bro. Know,
yeah, but it's the same. Like the only reason why, for example, some of the modern holidays that have taken off, for example, like Mother's Day and Father's Day, the only reason why we celebrate them is because you have to celebrate your mother and your father.
Okay.
And so that works. But when it's like Day of Racial Equality Day, let's say, I don't know, like whatever name of a day you come up with, you know, it's like help the orphans day. It's like no one celebrates those things. And of course you have to help the orphans. I'm not saying you shouldn't help the orphans. I'm okay. Just saying that the way that the modern world can see, and it's partly the scientism problem, partly the kind of secularist problem, where it's that we are communities of people. Love happens between people.
Yeah.
We're connected to events in history and we're connected to people. And that's how we cohere. And so we celebrate saints. We celebrate God. Ultimately, we celebrate Christ, who is the place where those two things come together. You know, we celebrate stories, but we keep trying to celebrate identities and celebrate it's not. And but it's that, weird. Like, it's weird to have.
They're pushing like, that, though. Like, yeah. Like, day of this remembrance, day of this thing, and it's being pushed by the corporate zeitgeist. Oh, yeah. And then the identitarians get on board with it, and they push their thing, so.
But it's a scary thing because... you know, you have, let's
where
say,
is it broken then? What at what point?
Broken because what happens when you have white month? That's where it's broken.
Well, every month because is white month if these people are to be believed, right?
Yeah.
Because the white people invented the calendar and time is on their side. So I'm being facetious, but actually that's what's in the literature. So
yeah, that's what they'll say. But then at some point, someone is actually going to come up with that. If that movement gets bigger and bigger, then at some point someone's going to have to come up with that. He's going to have to.
And why is that not tenable? Why is that not tenable?
Because you don't want that. It's not going to. This is the problem. There's a meme going around, which is really a scary meme. And it's a meme where there's a, let's say, a kind of Black Lives activist who's usually white. And then there's a Nazi who's white. And they're both saying the same thing. They're saying white people have privilege. You know,
it's sinful to deny that.
White people have this and that. And it's like, that's some scary stuff.
Okay. So I understand why it's scary on a visceral level because of, let's just put it into the Nazi box, right? Like there's this Nazi box over there. Like there's that nakedness of a certain strain of Western reality that we have to be aware of and that it's wise to be wary of. But why in beyond that, why is it problematic that white people are being asked to assume guilt and to carry around their privilege and to be reduced into this identity? Like what is it? There's an aspect of, of Christianity that does have that kind of self-flogging stuff gone wrong. Why could you tie that together? Could you guys make,
well, because it's only one group that's asked to do that. Right. If in Christianity, everybody is the lowest of sinners. Like you're supposed to see yourself as the lowest of sinner and ask forgiveness. And, you know, I get emails all the time from monastics who end their letter with, please forgive me, the lowest of sinners, you know. Yeah. And so there's a sense where you have to do the work inside you. But, you know, let's say we watch this strange thing that happened when we saw the washing of the feet, right? And you saw a bunch of white people washing the feet of the leader of the protest, let's say. And it's like, could that happen the other way? I don't know. Could it? Would it be a scandal? I don't know. It's very odd. It just ends up being very scary. It's a scary space to enter.
There was a video that surfaced just before that where the white people were kneeling and praying for forgiveness from the black people, and then the black people, they did equalize that. And it was a communal thing, but it was still pretty shocking for that symbolism to all of a sudden intrude into this rather secular movement, or this rather, if that's such a thing, like that Black Lives Matter political movement.
And there is a way in which, you know, in the Bible, it says, in Proverbs, it says to bow down to your, on your face if you're going to ask forgiveness of someone, as if anybody does that anymore. Mm-hmm. There is this sense that you need to do that, but it's weird to do that because of your identity. Man, it's just weird. It's just scary. I don't know. I just find it very scary. Like to apologize for my sins that I see and I recognize, and to ask forgiveness for that is one thing. But to like bow down for my ancestors' sins or for like a systemic sin that is part of my identity, I just don't see how that can lead to anywhere good. Because some people are going to bow down and then some people are going to clamp down. Hmm. Right. Well,
I think that video you did, Ben, of the New York City education group was telling, because
city council where one woman is several women are flogging one male for bouncing a brown baby on his white lap.
Right. Yeah. And the, you know, the litany is you have to do the work. Okay. Now, again, in a Christian context, yes, you have to do the work. But anybody who's actually doing the work understands how hard the work is. And with this universalization, which is rehearsed and practiced within the church, of I am the sinner, you begin to realize that part of your finger pointing is your failure to do your own work. And that's why you have this interesting dynamic among saints where, like someone like Saint Francis, that there's a figure that many today would look at and say, well, Saint Francis was a holy man. Saint Francis and many saints like him were intensely aware of their own sin. And that intense awareness gave them a humility and gentleness with people who were far greater sinners than they themselves. Mm. And that then had power. Mm. Because people don't respond well to accusation. They sometimes will respond well to love. And so in the Garden of Gethsemane, when Peter pulls the sword and chops off the ear of the servant of the high priest, you know, Jesus heals it. And in a sense, Jesus says to everyone in the garden, if anyone's blood is going to be shed here, it will be mine. And, you know, this is after the Gospel of John, where Jesus, you know, I am he, and everybody falls back in the Gospel of John, which is this moment of just enormous revelation of power. This is the power of stilling the storm and raising the dead and healing the sick that everyone had manifest. And if Jesus has that kind of power, a little squad of temple guard are no big deal for someone with that kind of power to manage. But yet Jesus at that moment says, and that's exactly what you don't see in that interchange with everybody piling on of that guy, do the work. And it's like, well, if you understand what the work is, this angry posture of finger pointing is antithetical to the work of embracing yourself as a colonizer and as a racist. Who are you, racist, to call out the other racist? Mm-hmm. If you actually are more fully aware of your racism than what you see manifest in this one person bouncing a brown baby on his lap.
Hmm. You know what? There's a shadow version of what we're seeing, where these identities are broken apart. And so there are all the identities are fighting, but there's this inverse of that of, you know, is racism a big enough sin to contain all the other sins? And it seems like racism as a sin is too small of a box for, and they're trying to shove all this stuff in there. So they're like, well, there's phobia. There's this kind of phobia, that kind of phobia. Like, okay, we have all these different boxes. It seems like the, not only the heavens are broken, but hell is broken too. And all these different, you know, competing, you know, aspirations and identities and negativities.
I agree. I think that the idea that the only value possible is inclusion, I don't think that's a way to, for reality to exist. It's a very strange, it's a value that has to be moderated with other values. And yeah. You can't just have that one value, especially just because, like I said, the world just doesn't work that way. You know, the best way is to have a sense of who you are at different levels and different groups, because we're not just one thing, and we're all several identities. We all have different groups and identities that we identify with. The best way for me is to understand where you are, who you are, which identities are manifested in you, and then in understanding that, then be able to love those that are outside, like to love the stranger in every way that's real for you. You know, it's not only in terms of race or in terms of nation, it's also in terms of your house and in terms of the people outside in the street. You know, the notion that you need to love the stranger, and love doesn't just mean absolute inclusion. It doesn't mean that. Right? It's not true that I'm meant to include all the strangers into my house. It just doesn't work. It's just not going to happen. And so there needs to be moderation, you know, compassion and judgment. There needs to be the left and the right hand, this coming, pulling closer, keeping away, all of this stuff, this kind of breathing in and out of identities is the normal way to go.
Yeah. That evokes the image of the amount of polarization. You know, there's these charts that show like how, like in the United States Congress, like how close people are over the decades or how close they work together, or the connections, and it's just getting back separated and separate and separated. And I think that's happening on that level of a legislative level, but also in the values that we go back and forth between, like build the wall and then tear down the wall, you know, free healthcare for everybody and no immigration reform, you know, like these totally like these values are so extreme that they don't actually work. They don't actually work. If you just listened what the left wants to do and if just what the right wants to do, like they need each other, and there's a brokenness between those two aspects, it seems like.
Yeah, it is interesting to notice, if you actually listen to the things that are being said, is, you know, this is something that people have tried in me recently. They've said, look at what most of the right-leaning people are saying, and there is no one saying just us. Like, no one is saying that. And there are very few people saying that. And so it's like the whole pendulum is being pulled on one side, and whatever is on the other side of where the extreme is that's an extreme. So the idea that you need to have some kind of, just the idea of a border, that you need to have a border, you need to have some kind of process to vet immigrants, all of a sudden that's racist in itself. It's like, man, that is a very reasonable proposition. Now, we're not Nazis here. We're just saying, okay, you need to make sure that people that, like, just like your house, you know, you need to make sure the people come into your house are not going to come into, they're not the bad people. There are good people and bad people out there, but you don't know them. So you need to get to know them before you let them in, right? So that's difficult, because as we're being pulled in one direction, it's as if the reasonable ones that are trying to find a middle ground are getting smashed because they're being treated as if they're extreme. But I don't think that a lot of the discourse is extreme.
Yeah.
Like, at least when you see, I mean, I think, Benjamin, you've been kind of on that path where you've noticed that, you know, you have Brett Weinstein, who is actually very liberal, but is somehow seen as a fascist Nazi. And that's just someone like Joe Rogan or all these characters are not at all like hard right at all.
Yeah.
And so I don't see an easy solution to that. You can't say the middle, like you can't also go into the middle. You can't say, well, I'm going to be in the middle between these two extremes, but it's like, no, there's, I don't see the other as an extreme. So I don't know how to find the middle between the two.
Yeah.
It's ironic that we're having this conversation where everyone complicit in the current system is a white supremacist. When 3 or 4 years ago, there was a survey done finding that people today were more open to having their son or daughter marry someone of a different race than they would be of the opposite political party. And so you really have to ask yourself, well, what polarities are we actually working out here? Is it really race? Mm-hmm. And, you know, as Jonathan noted, Barack Obama, when you look at, in many ways, the policies of Barack Obama as compared to George W. Bush, it was very much continuation, the immigration policy, many of these policies. And you basically are functionally labeling Barack Obama a white supremacist. Mm-hmm. And it's just insane. It's just insane.
Mm-hmm. But it's addictive.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's self-righteous.
Sure. Oh, that Paul, that article you sent about the Internet of Beefs was just amazing. I was so happy. Paul sent this, it was an article called The Internet of Beefs, and it's all about how internet culture favors these beefs between people and these personal beefs, almost like a kind of this image of a feudal, these feudal warlords that are beefing and have their, they call them knights and mooks, and the language was great also because it gave me words for things that I could see happening. The idea that some people will act as like vassals to knights and fight for them, you know, and then they fight each other, and then the knights are on top and they kind of fight each other as well. And in the end, it's all for attention. It's really more about attention than it is about actually solving the problem.
Mm-hmm. And a cheap form of attention, I would argue.
It also ends up being money. Like, it's not just attention.
Yeah.
There's also an economic aspect to it, at least on the internet, you know. You see that quite a bit.
So earlier in the conversation, towards the beginning, you brought up, Jonathan, about the proposition of modernity was specialty. And then the proposition of, you know, the 90s on was specialness, right? And how, you know, you don't worry about your competency, worry about, I guess, just produce yourself. Produce yourself and exploit yourself. And there's actually a pretty fascinating actual survey or study done about the ways in which moral grandstanding, like it facilitates certain personality traits, and narcissistic sociopaths will benefit from a system that, you know, surprise, surprise, if you can prove that you're a victim, then you're going to get to the top of the hierarchy, which is exactly what you see in absurdist detail with the Evergreen State College. Mm. What is the solution? What's the next step then? If we can't rely on specialty alone or competency alone, and specialness is actually pretty toxic gone wrong. I mean, you need to have self-esteem, you need to have pride, but we're going at it the wrong way. And when you put on the social pressure, those values actually collapse or cause really strange phenomena, not only the rioting in the street, but at least in democratic ruled areas, like just the bowing down to these mobs and then the restraining of authority to allow these mobs to do this thing and like this really messed up loss of actual direction and authority. Like what is the proposition? Like what is the value? Like we talked about worship, we talked about a higher kind of modus, but is there, where do we go from here? If consumerism.
Well, I don't know where we go from here, but I can tell you what I think I think the solution is hierarchy, but real hierarchy. Like I know when I say
based
that,
on what? Can,
well, it depends at what level.
Okay,
depends in what field. Like each field has their hierarchy. You know, there is a hierarchy of authority in terms of the state for sure. And there is a hierarchy of competence in different fields. Like, there are hierarchies of competence in different fields. And there are hierarchies of authority also in your family. There are hierarchies of, you know, there are different types of hierarchies.
Yeah.
In different fields. So
there's even hierarchies of vulnerability or of oppression. Like, this group needs more attention than this other group. Like, there's a hierarchy
there is. Yeah. In that sense, in the sense that you need to prioritize certain things. But I think that when I say hierarchy, I really mean it in a Christian sense. I really mean it in a balanced sense, where there has to be, in order for a real hierarchy to function, there has to be care and love coming from above, and there has to be support coming from below and trust coming from below. And when that breaks down, then that's when you end up having extremes which start to manifest themselves, you know. And you can see it, like, if you look at the French Revolution, you can see it there happening, and it's far away from us that you can talk about it without being controversial, where the nobility, because of technology, because of all these different things, the nobility stopped being connected to their serfs, stopped being connected to the land, went to Paris, let their land, you know, just left their land alone. Things were being managed over there. They went to Paris, they did their thing, they just went to balls, and it was just a disconnected elite that didn't feel like it was their responsibility to care for the needs of the people that were under them. And that fomented revolt. Now, I'm not justifying the revolt, but it did. And it's normal for someone whose parent doesn't care for them to want to rebel against your parents, right? And so that's, then when that starts to happen, when you can't trust your authorities, then you have this fomenting at the bottom. And the tendency is to try to clamp down on the authority side. Right. And you can imagine in a family, right, the parent doesn't care for their kids. The kids is going wild and going crazy. So finally the parent says, OK, well, that's it now. I'm going to put my foot down. And from now on, things are going to go this way. And it's like, well, it's too late now, my friend. It's too late.
Well, they're not doing that. That's the weird phenomena. Like in Portland, they're allowing the Antifa to raid police things.
It's going
to
come. It's just a question of time. It's inevitable. The pendulum cannot go indefinitely in one side. It's going to happen. The same thing was going on in 1920s Germany. The same thing happened before the Spanish Civil War, and things at some point flip. And so this is what people don't understand, is the pendulum never just goes in one direction. And so right now people are like, okay, you know, it's okay. But if the protests and this type of behavior goes into the suburbs massively, people are going to freak out and are going to, it's one thing to watch it on television and to watch it on the internet and on YouTube. And it's another thing to see it outside of your door. I think at some point people are going to ask for a clampdown. It just might take a little while, but it's things don't calm down. It's going to come the other direction.
Napoleon followed the French Revolution.
That's right.
Yeah, they beheaded the king and elected an emperor. They did really good there.
But they had the same thing happened in Russia. You know, Stalin came after the revolution, and it's just that's just the dangerous path of this type of dynamic.
And have we seen? Are there precedents for that slowing down, or for a concession of some sort of soft, hard ruler kind of thing?
I mean, it's hard to know because the rulers always write the write the history.
Yeah.
But Augustus is seen, Caesar Augustus is seen as that. Like, Caesar Augustus is seen as someone who came in after the chaos caused by Julius Caesar, because Julius Caesar was a revolutionary. People always forget that. He really was a revolutionary. And then Augustus came in, and he both was the most powerful person in the empire, and then he renounced all his power officially. Mm-hmm. Unofficially, he remained the most powerful person in the empire, but officially he renounced all his power. So he played a game where he was able to at once, on the one hand, not have any form of official authority, and on the other hand, kind of hold autoritas in a kind of be the most influential person in Rome. And then he was able to stabilize the empire.
Sounds like a deep state wet dream.
Yeah.
Well, look at Putin too. I mean, Putin similarly, after, you know, the breakdown, you had Yeltsin, and then finally Putin, former KGB agent. You know, look at China. I mean, the chairman is now chairman for life. I mean, there's a there's a pattern to this. And I think in many ways the United States dodged this in the 30s because of the Second World War. It sort of forced the United States into a different role. And then, of course, you have the triumph of the Western powers. Then we have the Cold War that also disciplined and forced the United States into a different role.
Okay.
But at the end of the Cold War, which is really between 89 and 2001, that's a transition period. Now it's a very dangerous point for the United States because we are the empire. And
We lack discipline, and we're not even disciplining ourselves.
Right, right. And there's no outside force to discipline us. Now, that might become China. You know, we don't, you know, COVID is now going through, but this is a very dangerous, I mean, that when I listen to Brett Weinstein, I mean, I think he is right in that this is a very dangerous place for the United States right now and for the world because of it.
Yeah. I have to admit that I'm not like, I'm sort of a royalist. Like I'm not hiding it. Like I think that I don't think that, let's say.
You are.
I'm waiting for the apology of that Megan character. Is this where we're headed now? Jonathan's like, oh, you know, she's not really got the prince's ear too much. You know, he's just.
What is this?
Well, you know, the prince, like mouthing her social justice rhetoric now. No. Like his wife just watching him. Like, you're saying the right thing, darling. You're saying the right thing. Darling.
Prince, yeah, he also kind of disavowed his royalty and stuff. It's weird. Okay. It's disturbing stuff. I mean, I'm not royalist. I'm mostly in the sense that I do believe that there has to be someone who transcends the multiple identities. And so that's the thing about the notion of a king is that he's not one of the king is always a synthesis of all the people. Like the king is never one of the ethnic groups in his kingdom, right? Because of all the alliances that the powers had to make to even for the king to be there, he's always like, he's kind of above the fray in a sense. And so, you know, there are a lot of countries today, I would say even England itself only exists because of royalty. Because would you think the Scots and the Irish and the English have enough in common to keep them together if there's nothing, there's not even a symbolic thing above it, above their identities kind of holding them together? I don't know.
Yeah. Yeah.
Paul's like, Jonathan is really.
This is fascinating. he's right in that, what happened in the United States is that, okay, no more king. Well, what do we have instead of the king? The president, the military all pledge their loyalty to the Constitution.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So we have this set of ideas and these practices that function in place of the king. That's deeply Protestant. And you have to remember that the United States, the southern states, Virginia, these were all settled by economic opportunists and basically colonial drug dealers. Tobacco was the most popular drug of the world.
Yeah.
But the northern United States, above the Mason-Dixon line, these were all Protestant separatists who fled to this new land to get away from monarchies. And so this was all played, you know, this stuff moves very slowly through time. And we're so used to these little, you know, we think if something takes 10 years, it takes forever. But these things take hundreds of years to unfold.
Yeah.
So Jonathan's point, I think, you know, we're still working through the Protestant Reformation and the American and French Revolutions. We really are.
Yeah. And the thing about the United States is, this is going to be controversial when I say it to you guys, so get ready, is that I don't think that the United States is united under its constitution. I think that the United States is united under a story that it has for itself. And that's why, as the story,
the American dream
apart, yeah, the American, well, they're just the idea of the colonies and the revolution and the freedom, and then the Civil War is also a story that is really try to create, and they're trying to break down whoever resists, like the story of the Civil War. They try to get rid of that. So you have one story. So we have one story of the American Revolution, the Civil War, and everything. That is what is holding America together. But in time, especially as you grow and you also have a bunch of people that come in that aren't part of that story, that don't feel like it's their story, at some point it's inevitable also you're going to have, and also those that were marginalized out of that story from the beginning, which is the secret sin of the United States that I talked about. Like, the slavery in the United States is the secret sin of the founding, which is that here we say equality and freedom, and we're also not doing it, you know. And so as the system breaks down, the nakedness of Noah starts to appear. And then it's not, the Constitution is not going to hold the country together. Sorry, guys.
Well, we're more personal. The kings, you just kill them. I mean, yeah, that's, that's how you process that.
We kill the king.
Well, that's exactly what they do. Charles, you know, Louis, that's how you have the revolution. You kill the king. And then, you bring in Napoleon.
But closer to the way that you try to analyze things, though, is that the world is more personal.
Yes.
It's more personal and story and person driven than it is idea and, let's say, principle driven. And we see the principles have to be embodied in people and in stories for us to feel attracted to them. Mm-hmm. It can't just be, you know, generic.
And that's why Obama was so beloved by the left, because in his story, Obama and Michelle, you know, Barack and Michelle really became royalty to the left in the United States. I mean, so much so. Trump has some of that, but, you know, but his base is smaller.
Yeah. No, for sure. The Obamas did manifest a story. Like, they manifested the Civil War, civil rights story in their persons, and also I think Obama was also, in his demeanor, he was able to kind of to embody the story in a way that was extremely soothing and elegant, and so it also made it like a success story. It was like, you know, he wasn't, you know, if Obama had been abrasive, let's say, like Donald Trump, I don't think it would have worked as well, you know. Because he was so good at speaking, and he was, you know, he was witty and in a very kind of suave way, that helped for sure to kind of embody that story of success of the story of the United States. But it's just crazy that from that time to now, it's just like complete. And then all of a sudden the whole system is broken, and the, you know, systemic racism everywhere, and everything is, wow.
Well, that is one of the appeals of the systemic racism narrative that took over, because it mirrors very closely the reality, but it's divorced from reality. And by what I'm talking about is that this invisible virus comes through and is lurking everywhere, and we all have to hide from it. And we all get obsessed with this narrative, like there's this invisible force that's eating us alive. And then when that dam breaks and the energy has to go out, it finds a similar narrative in terms of this systemic invisible force of whiteness, which is basically this bacteria that just infests. No, they even, one CNN commenter called it a mind virus. You know, it's like white people just have this racist virus that's going to be enacted at any moment, and they're going to call you on the phone. So in a way, these narratives are, I don't know what the powers and the principalities are one thing, but I don't have like a, I don't have a story for what a story is, right? I don't know how to conceptualize like what is it that a narrative is and how it functions. And with regards to when you brought up the First Amendment, let's say that that's a, that is where we're unified. It doesn't really hold water as a point of unity, right? And you see that in the working out of this kind of debate between free speech and cancel culture. There's something missing in that debate. There's all these elite literati like working through this story, but there's all these instances of people getting shut down across the country. But there's no, there's nothing. The values are somehow removed. It's this like you said. There's this. There's not that gel, that narrative gel that like allows us to know what we're actually talking about in a way.
Yeah. Well, I think that the way that there could, I think really do believe there could be a way to have an integrated story. But it might be too late. I think there could be a way to have an integrated story, which unites the light and dark sides of the American story. It doesn't try to hide the dark sides. But doesn't also see either one as needing to eliminate the other in order for the story to exist. And that's why I mentioned that epic storytelling tends to do that. But I don't know. I don't know who can do that. And I don't know if it's possible anymore. It might be too late.
Well, I think these stories emerge. So the story that was David Brooks a couple of years ago made this comment that, you know, the story is breaking down. This was a story that, so I'm in my mid-50s. This was a story that was commonly told in the late 60s, early 70s, back in the 50s, of what America was, who it was, why we were the good guys, so on and so forth. And it's quite clear that, okay, that story is breaking down. But these communal stories emerge, and that's why, you know, when people sort of, I remember when Barack Obama spoke at the 2004 Democratic convention, that speech was like, wow, suddenly you saw the king and and his story. And, you know, he had a white mother, an African father, you know, and he just embodied it. And so the question will be, will a new story emerge? That I think Jonathan mentioned that on the Stoa conversation about the nakedness of Noah, I thought that was just bang. That's dead on right. That's dead on right. And there's going, I mean, because when you're reading through the book of Genesis and you're reading and there's Noah, and then there's this weird story about his drunkenness and the curse. And it's like, what's happening here?
Yeah.
But I think Jonathan sort of, you know, puts it exactly right there. So the question will be, will a new story emerge? Will a leader, and I think everybody understands Joe Biden is an older story, but it's an older story trying to buffer the Trump story. And, but we don't know. I mean, because, and this is why, you know, this is why systems have agency and stories have agency. And these are principalities and powers. And this is the level at which things are working. And we participate in them. But this again, you go back to the Apostle Paul.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. But someone, so Christ, the question I think we have here with respect to Christianity is, did Christ actually conquer the principalities and powers? And so when I look at Jonathan Peugeot's, let's say just use your last name, here you are. When I look at Jonathan's kind of cyclical, Chesterton makes almost the exact same point in the last chapter of The Everlasting Man, that, you know, the seven deaths of Christianity. I don't think there is I think the reason Christianity is so enduring and keeps coming back is there isn't a better story that actually manages all of these parts. And I at least hope that this is what we will find again, that at some point, those who say, no, it's patriarchy, no, it's race, no, it's gender normativity, at some point, the people will begin to say, well, guess what? I'm Jew and Dutch, and I took that 23andMe test, and I've got African and Asian, and genetics doesn't really do it. And gender, well, my mother's a woman and my father's a male. Yeah. So, you know, and we begin to realize that the cross, I mean, this whole story is a story that actually can work for us, and you can build a society on that story. But what Jonathan's video about Kanye just made me see was, no, I'm serious, man. I'm serious. But the problem is, can you bring God back into the conversation in a way that doesn't look cringy?
Oh, okay.
Well, I think that Kanye is doing it in a way that looks crazy. I don't know if he's cringy.
So you just bypass the cringe. No, you just cringy. Go.
That's the power of it.
Is Kanye West capable of cringe? Really? I don't think he is. I think he's capable of wild energy. I think that someone who defines the culture as much as he does is, I don't know if whatever he does is, if it looks like cringe, it's not going to be because he has so much influence. I think that Kanye is playing a role in this, and I really appreciate the way that he's able to kind of just say things in a wild, just this wild manner, and just say things that no one's allowed to say, and he's still doing it, and he's still saying it. And I do think that, to Paul's point, I do think that we're going to see, and we're already seeing, a new flame of Christianity being lit. I do think that's happening. Now, whether or not that's going to be a kind of remainder, or, you know, or if it's going to be an actual force to, I don't know. But, you know, let's say the best case scenario, yes, and then worst case scenario is an arc.
Oh.
Is build an arc.
Yeah, okay. Well,
Benjamin, your point earlier about, do you have to go through Antifa? Yeah. I think that's true. Because when you get to the point that, okay, you've won, but now you have blood on your hands.
Yeah.
Now you see yourself both as victim and tyrant. Yeah. What do I do? And I think it's at that point where you're the centurion looking up and saying, surely this man was the Son of God. Hmm. But I think right now, the concept of Son of God is so out of reach for us that we don't know what God means.
Yeah.
And we don't know how sonship functions within that story.
There's this series of events in Olympia. I'm just outside of Olympia, Washington. And when the protests kind of were first going on, the mayor bowed to the protesters. She bowed with them, but it was very evident that she was bowing to them. They kind of bowed with her. She had one of the interim police chiefs bow with her. You know, she tried to get the cops to bow with her. And then a couple weeks later, the protesters came to her house. And even though she has the Black Lives Matter poster in her window, they still spray painted Black Lives Matter on her house, right? And then she calls them domestic terrorists, and then she gets piled on by the, I'm sorry to use this phrase, the Karens come to the city council meeting and just scream about how this is the age of Trump and you're, you know, taking these protesters, you know. But at that beginning of that series of events, she's giving a speech to the protesters right before she bows to them, and she says, we're on stolen land. It's time for the white people to give back. So there is no... there's no commonality there. There's a collapse. There's a collapse beginning with the leadership. And you see this at the Evergreen State College, where you have the rising tide of the protesters. And then George Bridges just like, oh, I'll do whatever you want. And like, he just squirms around and puts the president puts his hands in his pocket, you know, and there's this absence of fatherhood, of that upright pillar, you know, and therefore the whole system just breaks down into mush.
Well, what sacrifice is big enough to propitiate the sins of the colonization, of racism? What sacrifice is big enough? I mean, reparations, how much money?
Yeah, you know, it's not enough. I mean, they want moral reparations, too. They want reparations on every given level. They want you to say the right thing, post the right picture, give the right money. And so there is no limit.
So where can you find an infinite sacrifice to give? I think we're back at Christianity.
Back at Jesus.
Yeah. I don't know any other way out of this.
I don't know any other way out of it either, Paul. And I believe the same thing as you. Maybe I just have less hope in seeing it actually. Hmm. Right now, at least, I'm not sure how it's going to play out. But I of course I agree that that's it. Like the ultimate scapegoat, the final scapegoat, the final. Hmm. That's the story of Christianity. And that's what it's supposed to be, at least.
How did it end? Can you guys refresh me? Like the apocalypse happens. What happens at the end? You know, so the end of the world, you get through it, and there's this beatific vision, right? Like what was the holy city, the
Jerusalem, the heavenly Jerusalem coming down, and death is destroyed, and the death is thrown into the fire.
Would that death be that nakedness? Would that death be that shame? Or,
well, for sure, the shame is definitely part of death. That's for sure. Yeah,
I think Jonathan Peugeot needs to do his symbolic series on the Book of Revelation.
Oh my goodness, can you imagine that? That would be that book is like
it's a little trippy, I have to say.
It is really, really difficult. It's so difficult because it really is a synthesis of everything, and so it's very difficult to talk about. Yeah. Hmm. Talk about hints of it, but the whole thing.
We often reach this point of apocalypse, and there are all these resets within the story.
Yeah.
You know, the day of the Lord, you first meet the day of the Lord in the book of Joel. And if you look at the book of Joel, are they talking about chariot riders or are they talking about locusts? And again, in sort of a modernistic frame, we want to sort of choose and say, well, it's definitely locusts or it's definitely warring chariot riders. But no, it's the pattern laying itself out. And so the day of the Lord is apocalypse, which is revelation. Now, is this the final one or will we go now into a new cycle? Yeah. But again, these are cycles within cycles, yeah. Because the long cycles are, again, we're still working through the Protestant Reformation in many ways.
Yeah, what crisis has like a turn thing to it, right? Like there's that, yep. That revolution.
Which is why, and I think, Jonathan, you said it, Kanye can't be cringy. But if Dennis Prager says the nation should turn to God,
yeah.
We all cringe.
Yeah,
but we don't when Kanye says it. Why?
It has to do because he's a fool character, because he's a you know, because he doesn't wear a tie and a suit and he doesn't represent the system. He's a marginal figure. He's a wild card, and so when he says it, it can't be cringy.
But how marginal is he? He's a multimillionaire. He's married to. Billionaire. He's married to the queen of.
Yeah.
You know, what is Kim Kardashian?
Yeah, influencer culture. Yeah.
But he definitely embodies the fool aesthetic completely. You know, what is his first album? He's wearing a big teddy bear suit. Did you see the cover of his first album? Hmm.
But is that intentional or is that just random association? Do you think?
Well, random association is part of a foolish behavior. That's what random association is. It's part of meaning breaking down. When you have random things and you associate them together, that's what break down a meaning. We're so used to it because all our rock bands try to do it, and all of entertainment culture tries to do it. All the edgy entertainment culture tries to have these kind of chaotic associations, but that's what it is. Mm-hmm. So when someone who's in that world of chaotic association then turns and says, we need to unify under God. It's like, what? That's when the flip, that's this flip that I talk about.
Huh. Like a Dada baptism kind of thing. Like this guy just emerges.
Maybe from something like that.
So out I've got Dada. A question.
For, yeah, out of Dada.
I've got a question for both of you. Why? So Kanye announces this and then Brett Weinstein is like, call me. And I'm thinking, I've been watching Brett's, you know, Unity 2020, and it's like Kanye is your answer?
But I think it's because he didn't see the God part of that tweet.
Oh.
I think he just saw the unity part. He just saw that he said we need to unify. And he was like, yeah, that's what we need. We need to unify. But I think he maybe had a blind spot on the God part.
Someday I'm going to have you and Weinstein talk.
I don't think it can happen anymore. It's been too long.
Yeah.
But that'd be great. I would love to. I tried to get Rebel Wisdom to organize it, but I kind of know that it's probably past its time now.
Yeah.
I wish it would happen because at that point Jonathan made, that needed to be answered.
Huh. It'd be great.
Well, I'm going to let you guys go. This is a great little morning, like a Bible study kind of thing.
I guess. I have a headache. I think we went through like so much. It's so hard to talk about this stuff because it really veers on all kinds of problems. So it's a good headache, though. It's like a headache, like, okay, I need to say the right thing and not say something so utterly stupid that I'm going to damn myself forever, you know?
Well, what a friend we have in Yeezus, right?
You're right. Oh, man. Oh, mercy.
Oh, my.
It was really great to talk to you guys. I really always enjoy connecting.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you so much. We'll figure out what to do with the recording, and I'll get that to you guys later today. You guys can do what you want.
All right, cool. All right, Paul, it's good to talk to you, too.
Great to see you, both.
All right, bye, everybody.
Have a good night, or day.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye.